first off, I have a question for you. Let's talk about that shirt.
Yeah, man.
That is the raddest shirt in
all
the land.
And I kind of figured spring, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's
a little bit.
Well, he's got a Cthulhu face.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely got the transformation and just the idea of, you know, Geena Davis still wanted to stay with him up until the very end.
Yeah.
Well, now don't tell me. I haven't actually seen The Fly.
Yeah.
I'm dead serious. Dead serious.
That's right. You said... Oh, I'm sorry.
But I know what that is.
The Fly is actually... it's more heartbreaking than spring. It goes to some rougher places.
It gets really dark. That was, I mean, one of the things that surprised me so much about spring is that it stays pretty light. You know, like, I mean, there's moments of like real horror, but then it stays pretty light. So yeah, I mean, we'll back up a little bit. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Another episode of We're Gonna Need a Bigger Show. I am Mike D. Today, we are still at the Chattanooga Film Festival, and I am joined by two very special guests. Gentlemen, could you introduce yourselves?
Yeah, this is Justin Benson. I'm one of the directors of Spring.
And this is Aaron Moorhead. I'm the other one.
Who wrote? You wrote, right? Is that right?
Did you split up writing? I wrote it, but... Okay. But there's a lot of Aaron in that script.
Right on.
Aaron has a very, very... heavy hand in the development. We like to joke around. He's like the music teacher in Whiplash.
I never tell him good job. I was like, well, this sucks, but we'll shoot it.
Right. So I guess you've done three really high profile projects. I want to kind of back up. What was film
Resolutions high profile?
To me, it is.
That's cool. That's cool to hear that. All right.
Hell yeah.
I mean, Community, the horror community, I mean, we ate that flick up, man. I mean, that's
awesome.
We'll talk about that, but I want to talk about were you guys big film buffs growing up? I mean, when did that start for you?
It was kind of weird for me. I got started making films in sixth grade. Do you know the singer Bertie Higgins? He sang a song called Casablanca and...
is it Key Largo?
Key Largo, you know.
Oh, right.
And so you're probably thinking of the Beach Boys, but...
You know the song Key
Largo. So that's him. That was his thing. His sons were really... he's got two sons, Aaron and Julian, and they introduced me to like making stop-action Star Wars films. Aaron was my friend in sixth grade.
Awesome.
And so we started making them, and it was like instant. It was like instant. As soon as I like... You know, within like weeks of meeting and like hanging out and like doing stop action Star Wars films, I was already like saving my pennies for a camera and that was it. Like it was just done like that. What was weird though is I made movies a lot more than I would watch them.
Okay.
And I didn't like grow up on a diet of any particular type of movie. And there was actually a moment in like senior year of high school where I was like, oh man, I'm going into film school and I like haven't like I know I could list a lot of movies that I know I should have seen, and I like
sure.
I went to like the public library and I got The Godfather, I got Alien, you know, like I had to like
right.
go and like seek out ye old movies,
yeah,
because for me it was like, you know, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, you know,
right.
like the big budget fare and nothing else, and even the classics I'd missed, and then anything like obscure, like forget about it.
Yeah. How about you?
For me, I grew up watching a lot of movies by virtue of the fact I had two parents that would take me to the movies all the time, and then and just saw everything.
Sure.
Horror movies, sci-fi movies, you know, Spielberg movies, Nightmare on Elm Street movies, just whatever. And then when I entered adolescence, I was really, really entrenched in like Southern California counterculture.
Right.
And I probably didn't see a movie for years, unless you count like skateboard and snowboard and surf videos and stuff
right.
like that. And then when I was about 18 years old, there was this girl that I really liked, and she's like, oh, watch these movies with me. And we watched, like, I think it was like Chasing Amy, Dazed and Confused, Reservoir Dogs, Trainspotting, and like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Wow.
And those were all movies that spoke to me in a way that was like, oh, like instead of looking at it like, oh, like I always liked Jurassic Park, but I saw
sure.
those movies as like, oh, I think I can do that.
Yeah.
Not because it looks easy, but I understand the voice of that, and I understand like a personal movie
sure.
and the humanity in it, and also from a technical standpoint, some of those movies aren't impressive, but you do look at them and go, oh, I get it. I see how you do that, and it's very effective.
So did you both go to school for film?
Yeah, separately though.
Okay.
I went to Florida State and
okay.
went to... I don't even, it doesn't matter.
UCLA.
So when did y'all meet?
I had just moved out to LA.
Okay.
And I was doing an internship for a commercial company called RSA. And it means nothing. We learned literally nothing there except for, you know, we met each other.
Sure.
And it was my very first day there, like my fourth day in LA or something like that. And it was his last day. And so he kind of like, I just happened to pick his table. I was like, oh, you look cool. You know, because there's just a giant lobby full of tables and a bunch of interns just desperately waiting to get mail to sort. And so, you know, and I sat down with him. I was like, I should probably make friends in LA. And so, you know, we met and it wasn't like immediate, you know, that we started working together.
Sure.
It was more just like, oh, you know, I was like, I want to be a director cinematographer. He wanted to be a writer director. And we just kind of kept that in mind, and then we started working together on occasion. I like subbed in for as an assistant cameraman for him on a commercial once, and then as the DP, I got to shoot a couple, and then we realized we kind of I stole this whole story, but yeah, we just kind of realized we work, you know, really well, kind of holistically rather than in a director DP relationship.
Sure.
Much worked, and you know, it satisfied, you know, me wanting to direct as well. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
So I guess then, when did you? I guess resolution, when did that kind of be the thing that you were like, well, we can both do this together? I mean, to kind of kick off the partnership full force.
Yeah, we had basically over a set of just weird life circumstances. It was like there was a spec ad where our first AC fell through.
Mm-hmm.
And then you came on as first AC on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the DP fell through on the next one. Then he was the DP. Then as the DP, we were going through the script and shot listing and give a really good script note, like the best script note I'd ever gotten. It's like, oh, we should work closer and closer together.
Sure.
And then we did a couple more little things together, just working more and more holistically. And then I basically wrote Resolution with him and I doing it in mind, basically.
Right.
And then when the script was done, I went to him, I was like, you want to go and do this? And we just made it with the money in my checking account.
Yeah, that's one of the most stunning things to me is with that. I mean, you know, with Spring, I don't know if it was the case with the VHS segment, but you know, you guys are open saying, you know, we produce our own stuff. I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's definitely not the first thing I mean most filmmakers would think. What was the reasoning there?
It used to be just necessity, and now
right.
We realize it's totally like it's it gives you creative control and freedom.
Sure.
You know, before though, it's just because I remember even thinking about it as like being like, man, I wish there were producers out there that would just like want to make my stuff.
Right.
You know, I wish that existed. And I was like, oh, that doesn't exist, because if they wanted to do that, they would just be a director. And I realized that's not true. There's lots and lots of people that are very willing to take a, you know, basically they like to bring it together and bring a project creatively together, but they don't actually want to direct it.
Right.
So we just made our own stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But now we like producing our own stuff. It's
really?
Kinda, it's exhausting. I mean,
yeah.
we still hand off the reins to people who are much better than us at a lot of stuff.
Sure.
But I think it'll be a very weird day when we're not listed as a producer.
Okay.
Yeah. Probably. Yeah.
Yeah. We've gotten so used to doing it that way, and no one's going to care as much as you do.
Right.
At any given job, if it's your project.
Sure.
There are a lot of... really good, I guess, I don't know, what do we call them? Creative producers?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are, like, really good creative producers, and they'll, you know, they will come on board with us and stuff like that, but we just don't need it.
Because sure.
We already do that part.
Yeah.
What we really need are producers who want to get dirty and execute, and, like, they don't have notes. They have execution.
Right.
They have, like, I know how we can do this.
Right.
I know the vendors. I have the relationships. And that's our producer, David Lawson, mm-hmm. who we worked with in Resolution, Spring, and Bone Storm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for, I mean, Resolution, I mean, where did that come from? I mean, it's one of the most stunning films I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's so... And the same can be said of both Spring and Resolution. It defies expectations in so many different ways. I mean, where did that come from?
It was semi-autobiographical, really. Justin was hopelessly addicted to angel dust, and I chained him up in his apartment in Hollywood, and But I didn't get him sober. I just beat the hell out of him. I just beat the hell out of him for a week. Yeah. And now he fears me. You
know? Yeah. Yeah.
And now he can't get
away. And the events of that week were manipulated by a mysterious unknown force.
I think that I had a... It's funny that the conception of that movie, the main idea, the thing that started it, is something that some people, they can watch the finished film and they won't even get from it. Some right. people do entirely.
Sure.
But it was the idea of a, quite literally, of an invisible entity that operates via thoughtography. That is to say, it's there, it's observing you, and as it's observing you, it's sort of transmitting what it's observing to recordable media.
Right.
And that if this thing was very old, that it would start with like cave paintings, and then all the way up through hard drives and everything in between.
Wow.
You know, so yeah. like cave paintings, early photography, early film, digital media, all that stuff. And you don't actually, it's funny because that's like kind of like the conception of the idea, but you know, there's a lot of people that really enjoy that movie and they never get that from it. And there's some that do, sure. they get that entirely. But that was it. And then, but with that came with like the theme of control. Right?
Yeah.
That's about control. That's about using that media to control the subject. And then so what follows is in what situation do you want to control someone? And like anyone, you know, everyone has things in their life or people in their life who have dealt with addiction. And if you've ever, you know, had a friend who's you tried to help them through it, and you hit all these dead ends, you feel like you're constantly starting over, and you have this thought, it's like, oh, like, the only thing I could ever really do is take them somewhere secluded and chain them up.
Right.
You know, that was it. That was it. It was that theme of control and how that all connected. And
it's an extreme, yeah. it's a really extreme way of doing it in the movie, of course.
Sure, yeah.
You know, it's something that in many other situations you kind of, fantasize is the wrong word, but you do think about where it's just like, oh, you have your, you know, racist relative or something, and you're just like, look, if I could just have you for a week, you know, like I would get some sense into you, you know, like one way or another, you know, it's like, yeah, that's not the right way to do it. You're not supposed to control other people's lives and it's selfish, but like maybe you do know better, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's the question of Chris has and or Mike has in the movie. You know, it's just like, maybe he's being selfish. Maybe he's really doing it for himself. And, yeah. you know, but is it wrong? Maybe, you right know, here, maybe it's actually sure. wrong because yeah. he's just like, I chose this life and I'm fine with it. You know,
did either of you approach it one way or the other, whether or not, you know, what he's doing is wrong or right?
We didn't want to moralize.
Yeah.
Like, we wanted to just pose the question.
Sure.
With Vinny and Pete in rehearsal, we'd all talk about it, obviously a lot over, you know, the morality of what's happening, and it certainly came up that, you know, obviously the question is what Mike's doing, is it right, is it moral? The question came up quite a bit, and I think it shows up in the movie. Mm-hmm. There's that conversation between him and Chris, that emotional low point after Sophie dies, the dog.
Right.
Shane, they're talking, and Chris makes a lot of really good points in that scene.
Yeah.
Against Mike.
And then also it happens again in that the really long two shot of them kind of just like,
yeah.
having it out at
yeah.
the end. He's just like, I'm sorry, I guess I just came here to feel better about myself before I became a father and locked my own life in.
Sure.
You know, and it's kind of cool to see, you know, him as a bigger man, Chris as a bigger man, saying like, it's cool, you know,
yeah.
I kind of get it, even though it was wrong. I kind of get it, you know. And actually, I guess we kind of have that in Spring too, is that we always have, you know, we have a main character who's asking something of someone that's impossible, and it's very selfish, but, you know, he'd be irresponsible to his own heart to not
right.
to not ask it, you know, and to just try, at least, you know. And I think that's something that we never really quite realized as a through line, and, you know, might or might not stay as one, but it's kind of an interesting jump from one to the other. It's like, a lead who seems to be in the moral clear, and then it gets a little bit muddier when you're just kind of like, man, it's not quite right to ask that, is it?
Sure.
You know, but you should ask it. You should at least try.
Right. So, I mean, it's safe to say it's pretty high concept. I mean, there's a lot going on. After he finished it, and we talked to Jeremy Gardner a little while ago, and he, said he saw it on the festival circuit, kind of saw it at first.
He slept through it. And
yeah, that's what he told us.
He hated us when he first met us. I don't know why.
I don't even know why. I remember meeting him and being like, that guy's cool.
He turns to Christian and he's like, those guys are pretentious as shit, and then he sends him another, like in Brazil, he sends him a message. I love these guys, So it's just that it's wonderful.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, what can you do? Man, if I'd just known that and it stayed that way, I'd be like, Jeremy. You're like staying up at night and be like, oh man, what can I do? Man, if I send him like something, if I like send him like a case of beer, I think he'd just think of it as a bribe, and he'd be like, I hate these guys even more because now they're just tryhards,
But I mean, you took it out on the festival circuit. I mean, did you find that it was a hard sell? I mean, did you find it polarizing to people? I mean,
We were ready for it to be.
Sure.
We were told it would be.
Yeah.
What was actually really cool is, again, before we were on the festival circuit at all, we didn't know anything about it. We literally learned the phrase genre film on the festival circuit after it had already released. Sure. We didn't know anything about it, right. And we had to actually say, like, what is that phrase? Genre film? We didn't know what that meant. And now it's just like you drop it and I forget that my parents don't know what that means. But the... we were told that to be ready that it's polarizing. But the coolest thing, though, was our publicist on the first one. We got a publicist just for the festival. We don't know anything. And when we first sat down, they're just like, oh, this is one of those things that will hide from the press, and basically like giving a strategy of like what they would normally give a low budget horror film.
Right.
And what that means is like hide it from bad reviews. That's what they meant. True. And then they saw it. That was just our first meeting. And then they saw it and they're like, oh, we're sending this out wide. This is going to be great. And we're like, we didn't know what that meant. We're still kind of parsing what exactly right. That kind of thing meant. But we're like, oh, like, okay, maybe we have a little something here. And we're expecting a lot of polarization. But honestly, it seems like it was one of those rare instances of like respect your audience because they're cool with something a little bit different, Everyone seems to dig Resolution quite a bit.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
When we were developing it and making it and post production on it and everything, we were always so excited about so many things about it. Every little joke, every little bit of weirdness, and every little like spooky thing. And just trying to ramp all that stuff up and kind of theorizing in a room doing it and a really insulated was basically just Aaron and I. And actually, Al was probably in on that quite a bit because we mixed the sound for so long. Our perma sound guy. And then we go to premiere it. Somehow we got into a big film festival. Extraordinarily luck.
Thank you.
And we go and we watch it from the audience for the first time. And we see all the emotional reactions to all the stuff we had theorized in a room. And it was all working.
Right.
That was really, really, really neat. We had no idea. We thought, people could just fucking hate it, like every second of it.
Sure.
But it was really cool to see all those little beats hit. And then all the press comes out, and it's just like over and over and over and over again. It's genre bending. And that's such a weird thing because it still follows us around. But that was never the intent.
Right.
But it's a good way. You got to describe something. But it's always an odd thing. Because to us, it's just like, oh, what's right in the moment with our
movie that we're going to make. Like, we're going
to
make that movie. Like, we're not just like, oh, man, people are going to be so surprised when we blend horror and drama.
But yet, every reaction to everything we ever do is like, it's literally like the exact sentence with Spring will be, they tried to blend horror and romance, and it worked. And it's like, we didn't try to do that. We just made a movie we wanted to make.
So I don't know if blending is what I want to say, but I mean, with Resolution and certainly with Spring, was there a desire, even in telling the story that you wanted to tell, was there a desire to defy some sort of expectation? Or was it just...
I feel
story.
Like setting out with specifically that goal at the top of your list, you're going to fail.
Sure.
It's like saying, like, I'm going to make a viral video. It's like, well, things don't go viral because you tried to make it viral. You know what I mean? But does it give it a good indication if we kind of like feel like we're going down some like already trodden. Yes. Yes. Already trodden path.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, yes, I know this. This feels familiar, that kind of thing. We'll always, you know, we're weird dudes and we just don't really want to do it again purely for its own sake, just for shaking it up and you know, upset the status quo or whatever you want to say, you know. But you know, purely for its own sake, we just don't want to do it again.
Sure.
You know, not because it doesn't work. It probably worked great when they did it in The Godfather, but we just don't want to do that, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's what sets it apart.
To varying degrees of success. We try, you know, I mean, you can't help but have grown up and watched a bunch of movies, you know, like, but that's normally just kind of it's just an MO. And it kind of comes to us naturally. It's not really something that's at the top of our list. It's like, okay, what do we want to subvert today? You know, it's not really like that. It's just kind of a guideline of like, oh, this feels familiar. All right. But that's all inside of just telling the story we already want to tell.
Yeah. Sure. So, I mean, moving on from there, if you look at VHS, your segment, I don't know if this is true or not, but if I look at resolution and then I look at VHS, it seems like VHS is just the ultimate release for madness. Like, it's just this, fuck it. We are just everything.
Yeah,
we can.
We use the word ejaculatory.
When I say ultimate release, that's kind of the phrase that's going through my mind. I mean, how did that, to back up, how did it come to you? Like, how did VHS, the franchise, come to you? And, I mean, what was that process like?
We were at Screamfest in Los Angeles with Resolution. We were sitting outside having a beer after the screening, and Brad Misko walked by. He didn't stop. He was just walking. He's like, hey, you guys want to do a segment of the next VHS? We're like, yeah, we'd love to do that. Okay, cool, cool, cool. All right, you guys should do that. Send me some concepts. And we thought that was like, oh, they're asking us to do it. Yeah. They're asking us to do it. And we submitted like 7 different
concepts. What were some
concepts? Oh man, they were
Let's
cool.
Let's go through them. Let's go through them. Okay, so we had one where a SWAT team was
a no-knock raid.
A no-knock raid.
Where you have to have cameras legally?
Basically killed an angel, and it brought down like a bunch of angels on the house.
Holy shit!
Yeah. So we had that, and then we're kind of like, how many angels could a SWAT team kill if angels can be killed? And actually, that question, you just swap out the word angel for anything else, and that's the rest of the concepts. How many blanks could somebody kill if they could be killed? You know, so Bone Storm's that too.
Right.
There was
skeleton demons?
And then they didn't want that, so we did a different no-knock raid, where the no-knock raid goes in on there's like an 8mm projection of like an Anton LaVey type or like Aleister Crowley type doing a ritual.
Right.
And they like walk in right at the moment where it's basically been, what's the name of the ritual where it's
possession
it's done. Or? Yeah, I guess essentially a possession at that moment from the film. And one of the guys in No Not Great is possessed by this, you know, interdimensional demonic being thing. It turns into this like chase around San Diego on rollerblades, skateboards, motorcycles, everything across the city, and like a shootout in the ocean. It was insane. So, I'm so happy they rejected that one. Actually,
no, we didn't. We never sent it because I rejected it. No?
Because
I was like, that's like Crank.
Wait.
Oh, no, you're right, because the camera going into his chest.
Yes.
Sorry, this is crazy. This was a long process for us. You're right.
Then they said it was too tonally similar to the wraparound.
Right.
So we didn't. So then
we had one that I'm really sad we didn't get to do, which was fucking awesome, which is two loser, like, you know how people like, kind of like, let me use the right phrase here, but like a lot of like click outcasts, they get into like paramilitary stuff, but they don't join the military, they like love it, you know, and they can identify a plane flying over like exactly and like how many knots it's going.
Yeah.
That kind of guy.
Yeah. Right.
So there's two of these dorks. They go to skydiving, but one of them's strapped because he's always strapped, right?
So that's why the camera's on. Skydiving cameras everywhere, right?
Yeah. And something attacks the plane and they dive out, and basically it's a 6-minute, one long thing of they dive out with one parachute. Two of them. One of them has a gun, and they're fighting this thing in the air, trying to grab the parachute.
Was it just too complicated?
Like, somebody else submitted a fucking parachuting one, and they didn't want to have copyright issues.
So they rejected that one.
I was so mad about that, because I was like, that one's perfect. Holy shit. It's going to be so cool.
So then there was the. So then we're thinking, oh, action sports cameras. Okay, action sports GoPro cameras. This is that's our way into found footage. So like, okay, surfing. These guys are making a surf video.
This would have been impossible. I'm so glad they turned it down. I was thinking about it the other day.
It would have been horrible. Impossible.
Like Bone Stone was impossible. This is impossible.
Impossible. So basically, these old friends are getting together for like a weekend surf trip, and they go to this reef break. It's like one of these reef breaks, we get a paddle like 100 yards out and it's deep water all around it, but the wave breaks like right there. And they've all got their GoPro cameras on, like helmets, surfboards, everything. And if I can just give you like the viewer on one of the cameras can see like a shark coming towards them in the ocean. And then all of a sudden the shark just turns around and bolts the other way because there's something way worse there in the reef. Shit. And it becomes like this weird, like the reef is haunted and there's all these odd things happening. In the,
how the hell would we have done that?
We wouldn't be here right now. We'd be dead.
Yeah,
we
would be.
We would have
be still shooting,
and we would have probably killed a bunch of crew members. Yeah. They would have drowned, sunburned, scurvy.
The shark. How would we do scurvy? Anything underwater at all?
So that one got rejected, and I don't. Really actually, I think that's idea. Pretty much all of them. I think.
No, was another there was one? Like one or two more.
There was surfing.
Well, what was the three we submitted?
I think that was skydiving, surfing,
oh, right.
and but you know what, we never did do one. We could have done one for snowboarding too.
Oh yeah. Actually, we're hoping we have a TV show. And we're hoping to actually do a snowboard
weird snowboard shootout. Yeah,
and
yeah,
not like Jason Statham, though. But like something like a real one. Like what you know, like in a situation in which you actually had to do that. You know, like not where somebody could actually hit someone, but like you're being fucking shot at on a snowboard. You know, and you're going down the hill.
Yeah.
That's perfect. So, all right. So, you've come up with these concepts. I don't know how much of this you can talk about, but does it become your responsibility to finance the short?
For VHS?
Yeah.
No.
They give you a very, very, very locked set amount.
Okay.
That is very small, and you go do what you can do with it. And
so, with Bone Storm, was it a matter of working? You saw that figure and you're like, okay, we can do Bone Storm.
No. That budget should have never been done.
That was so irresponsible. We talk all the time about this thing, like, hey, just make sure you don't like make a movie that's like wearing your dad's like clothes, you know, like so you're not like trying really hard, you know, like when you make an action movie, you're stacked up against really expensive action movies. You can make a drama that's just as good because drama doesn't cost money,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But like an action movie, like if you can't have Fast and Furious 7 plane cars crashing into each other, you're stacking yourself up against that when all you have is your Subaru like does a little ramp. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like you're stacking up against those things. You're in the same genre here. And so that was in terms of not killing ourselves while trying to make a movie, that was a misstep.
Yeah.
Right.
We stretched a little too hard. And we still feel like we succeeded.
Yeah.
But
we love that short film.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And we think like with the amount of like with what we had, that is the best version of that short film. And
thank you David Lawson
and
everybody else, basically.
Everyone else who did favors. And
well, what's great is, I mean, you know, we've got three VHS films now, and in each one it's like people will pick out the segments, and I've never heard a bad thing about Bone Storm. You know, it's just it's so nuts.
It's
like, it's just so I think that's why it's just because it's all hitting you.
Yeah,
you know,
Someone said it right. It's like a like, well, actually, you have a great way of putting it.
It's basically Mortal Kombat, Call of Duty meets Larry Clark's kids,
and Tony Hawk's
Pro Skateboarding.
Right. Yeah, but you know, someone else said it's like a video game fever dream, which is like, all right, like that's about right, because you know, in these kids' heads, I can actually see someone, you know, skate kids of all kids,
right?
You know, that might not be like psychopathic, but might actually enjoy a really good fight,
right?
You know, getting to completely go gonzo with no real consequences,
sure.
You know, yeah,
yeah. The consensus on Bone Storm is interesting. You know, we follow, we listen to everyone, look at every comment, everything, right. And
is that hard?
Not really. Yeah. We've been really, really fortunate for the most part,
sure.
Especially with Spring and Resolution. But
yeah,
the
absolutely.
But with Bone Storm, the consensus is something like this. Very truly, we watch it very closely. Being honest with ourselves, it's like I'd say that like more than half love it.
Okay.
They love it, and then there's like 20% that are like, that was a really strong VHS segment. And there's like 10% that are like, that's the worst film I've seen in my entire life.
Wow. Literally. Yeah, like, there are a lot of people that can't hate it more than
they
couldn't hate it.
It is by far the most polarizing thing we've ever done.
So you talked about, I mean, you guys, you know, kind of killed yourself over making this. I mean, what were the challenges of bringing this thing to life?
Everything.
Really? Everything was hard.
Nothing was easy ever.
Every single thing
was
hard.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. You know, we will say that getting it approved was hard because we went through 7 pitches.
Right. Yeah.
That's hard. Yeah. And then finding the location was almost impossible. Sure. And then actually once we had a location scout for a bit, pulled a favor, you know, our producer pulled a favor, and they basically just came back with one word, watershed, ? And we're like, I don't know. Okay, no, not a watershed.
Cut to Aaron and I literally driving all over Los Angeles to random ditches we'd find on like Google Maps sometimes, and going up to skateboard kids and be like, do you guys know about this? Doesn't quite work. Do you guys know about anything?
We found that one by asking a skater for like secret skate spots, and he's like, all right, don't tell anyone. And that's where we shot.
But it's for days driving around, like walking around dirty ass ditches around LA that are really hard to find.
Yeah. And still 20% of that ditch was owned by like the army. So we couldn't like use 20% of that ditch. So you know, and then we still did.
Right,
but like that was, you know, we were just like mandated like that. Everything was hard. It was hot. It was so hot. You can't believe it.
There was a bunch of stunts. Literally a dead body found just over from set on the first day of shooting.
Yeah. There were a lot of stunts, and if you ever done stunts and practical effects, which are both, they are time sucks. And thank God we had this badass stunt coordinator and fight director called Vince Capone, and our special effects artist Vince Costini. Thank God they exist because they made that somehow, as hard as it was, actually just work. You know, but that kind of thing is like. You know, I just saw White God, and I'm like, oh, how long do they have to shoot that? Half a year? Because like, working with dogs is, like, impossible.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with practical effects and stunts. We had them both, and we had 3 days to shoot that scene.
Oh.
Or the whole ditch, you know, which is most of the movie.
And casting? Okay, first off, we always do. We put out a casting notice to cast the fucking movie. Put out a casting notice. Yo, put on a casting notice. Oh, I'm looking for, like... It was more eloquent than this. It was like, oh, we're looking for skater kids, like, who could look about, you know, 16, 17 years old. And, so skateboarders. Okay, if you put that on a casting notice in Los Angeles, all of a sudden every single dude actor in L.A. is a skateboarder. And you just get 5 billion submissions that you cannot weed through.
Yeah, and, like, everyone's like, I could learn to skateboard real fast. You know, of course. That's actually even Shane, who played the cameraman.
Yeah.
He's a good friend of ours, and we cast him in everything as our good luck charm, and because he's awesome. But he was even just like, if you need me to learn a skateboard, dude, I'll just learn. And I'm just like, it's not like that. Skating is like a lifestyle. It's not something you can just kind of pick up and BS, you know.
Right.
So he do that, you know.
So then for 3 or 4 days, Aaron and I are hanging out at skate parks around Los Angeles, walking up to kids, being like, hey man, we're making a movie. And
these like 17 are like, are you a cop? I'm like, can I take your picture and get your phone number and name? And they're like, you're sure you're not a cop? And I'm like, I'm not sure. I think I might be a cop. I'm like, this is so copy.
It was crazy. We we go to like local skate shops. We're like, hey, put out this casting call. Everything was creepy about it. And then we have this casting call day out at the skate park in Highland Park in LA, and it was so immediate. The long-haired one.
Yeah.
They don't have names in the movie, but his name in real life is
Nick.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
The long-haired one. Call him that?
The long-haired Nick. He shows up.
Right.
And we watch him skate, and he's just an amazing. You know, these kids are amazing athletes.
Yeah.
And we're like, wow, that's amazing. And visually, he's interesting to look at. He's got all these cool tattoos and just the most lovely guy. And then the shorter brown haired one kid shows up, Chase. And that was like, we all looked at him for about half a second. It's him.
Yeah.
It's him.
It was that guy.
And he rolled up with a cooler with a 40 ounce in it.
To his audition.
Wearing a Black Flag shirt.
Oh, perfect.
And just like, what's up, homie?
Yeah.
And
like, yo, what's up, homie? On my skate. He was so cool.
I was like, oh man, I've just been out cooled like so for the rest of my life by this kid.
Yeah.
And he's just like talking to me about like New York hardcore from the 80s. And I grew up in the late 90s, and I'm among that generation, and that stuff's retro, but you listen to it because it's cool. And there's this kid in 2013, 14. He's like, I listen to Gorilla Biscuits and like all this stuff. He's just like talking, like, I'm just like, who are you? Like, why are you yeah. like this?
He's also, weirdly enough though, you see him in the movie, he's so confident and stuff like that, but he's like, they're both crazy humble. They are so humble. And actually, one of my favorite moments I've ever had with him was actually after the movie. It was our U.S. premiere at Fantastic Fest, and we were being interviewed. And they'd asked, they don't get interviewed too much. You know, they're skaters, so they get interviewed for skate stuff. But they were pretty awestruck and starstruck. You know, they drove out like 22 hours to Austin, Texas in a road trip, only stopping once to skate because they had to skate. But anyways, so we're in the room, and they'd ask me and Justin, you know, some questions about Bone Storm and everything like that. And then they turned to Nick, and he goes, so Nick, when you were approached by Aaron and Justin, and they go, oh my God, I'm so hyped, you know my name right now. He was dead serious. It was like so cute. I just wanted to like dog pile hug him. Right? I was like, oh man, you are so humble. It is amazing. I need to take
it's
lessons
refreshing,
from you.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like beautiful. It's really beautiful. Yeah.
And like, it was crazy because, you know, you work with actors who have varying degrees of let's call it easygoingness, and like the requests you make of them.
Sure.
And these kids, you just be like, all right, here's the thing. I need you to do that thing again where you skateboard down that ditch, do a 6-foot air, pick up the sword, hit the skeleton with it, and do it perfectly. And he just does it 10 times in a row.
Wow. Yeah.
He's like, yeah, okay, cool, whatever. And he's been sitting in a hot ass ditch in East LA for 3 days. Doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. Doesn't care. Like, yeah. And so that's, you know, we can't even complain, but you know, because the camera was point of view, a lot of the stunts we did, and so you know that's exhausting. Going back to the what's so hard question, which I guess is the question.
Yeah, yeah.
But and then you know we'll tell an abbreviated version of the story. Is it cool? You think?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. One of our actors ditched. Originally, the script had all three of them surviving to the end. Gas Money Kid had a name. That guy just rolled out in the middle of the day, and we didn't know. We didn't know why. We didn't know.
Yeah.
Everything was fine. You know, it was actually going really well. And apparently he got bored or something like that. He made up a lie and
just took off.
And just took off.
Holy shit.
And and we didn't know if he was coming back. He was like lying to us about coming back. And we were really upset about that. And so we had to improvise. Thank God it actually made the movie better.
Right.
Weirdly enough, that like the two of them, because we were just you know the next morning. I'm being really honest here, but you know like the next morning, me and Justin had figured out about 3 hours earlier that it's like he's not coming back. That lie is a lie.
Yeah.
You know, like we didn't know. You know,
barely slept
and had barely slept because we didn't know what the hell was gonna happen. We didn't know what was gonna happen. You know, and then so he and I get to set really early, and we were near. You know, it actually you might not be able to tell, but there's a cul-de-sac right next to the ditch, and we painted out the houses every time the GoPro pointed at it. It was painstaking, we took like a couple really long walks around the cul-de-sac, just me and him, and kind of figured out this plan. Is like, I guess the movie is now about one tight friendship between these two skaters.
Yeah.
And you know, and we're like, all right, so we'll really amp up. You know, one of them is basically a hidden, you know, a closeted psychopath, and the other one is, you know, a little bit more easygoing and more resourceful. And you know, and like, okay, all right, cool. We could like spread out the abilities and had to basically remake the movie no sleep in 45 minutes, and I feel like it turned out better for it, weirdly enough.
And I actually just remembered something. David Lawson, he produces everything we do. He's our boots on the ground, salty, dirty, amazing producer. He had already said, you know, he had basically scheduled it out, and he'd already said the day before, he's like, yo, this day coming up is like, it's not just hard. This is unheard of hard. There are 14 practical effects gags.
Yeah.
There is so much to cover. And there's stunts in every single one, and I don't know if we're gonna get it. Can we get it, guys? We're like, we can do it. We can do it. We got it. And then when that dude bounced, that added, because we had to kill him, Well, like, we had to go back to Dave and be like, okay, you know, we said we could do that. Okay, well, we got to add another practical effects guy. We have a sword go through his stomach and blood blast out from a point of view. We could have someone run around and look like it was him. And it was just like,
do we have someone
seriously,
that looks like him,
guys,
to control his wardrobe? You know,
like, it was like we had to add shit, you know, to a day that people already looked at as impossible. We had to add at least three more setups that had stunts and practical effects.
Wow.
And we got through it. Remember we walked off set that day?
We actually were like hugging at the end. We're just like, oh my God, that work. We actually made our day. We weren't even behind the next, like, we could go shoot the next day, like, properly. You know, the only thing, you know, was like, oh yeah, you know, the sun drastically changed position one shot. And we had to color it really, really hard, and GoPro doesn't respond well to that. But that was it, you know, and I've never heard a complaint about it.
So, kind of moving forward to spring, when did that, the birth of that idea happen? And
it was at the same time when we were sound mixing Resolution.
Okay.
So we didn't have careers yet as filmmakers at all. Well, in the as directors, we didn't have careers. Aaron was working as a director of photography, cinematographer, and I was working as a production assistant. A lot of odd gigs, and sometimes working in restaurants, bartending, stuff like that.
He left a bartending gig and tried to give it to me, you know. And I pretended I could bartend, and then they're like, "You can't bartend." And they didn't hire me. Thanks for trying, though, man.
And I don't know. We were feeling in a really, everything about it was naive, but there's a lesson there. There's a very good lesson here, actually. I think it was, you know, the assumption that Resolution would do anything, that it'd get into any film festival, get distribution, or anything. Because the odds are stacked up against it. We didn't know anyone. And we didn't know what we were up against. We were just going to try. And Spring was written during that time, and just kind of written with the same kind of ethos that's behind Resolution. It was like, oh, I have unique ideas, character first, all those things. And
caution
then,
to the wind in terms of,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, just not really giving a fuck, just like, oh, like, this is interesting.
That was kind of it, yeah.
Yeah,
it's just that we found it interesting.
Yeah,
and so that was written during that time, and yeah, but the weird thing is that it was written with so little film business savvy. It wasn't a specific genre.
Right.
It took place in Italy. It has long stretches of non-plot forward dialogue, and those are like huge, the last one especially in development, like that's a big no-no, and then shooting in Italy is like, that's impossible. And then not being genre specific to a distributor is like, you're killing me.
Absolutely.
I need it to be one thing, you know. Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Draft House,
then they're just like, yeah.
So did you approach them first?
No. We got distribution after the premiere.
Okay.
But right. we've known them for a while.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Tim's been a hero of us. Actually, there's a little bit of a story too, interestingly, where you know, we'd made Resolution and it still was kind of just getting discovered. It was a sleeper kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
And when we were trying to package Spring, we had this idea that, like, you know, the place where everybody convenes is the Cannes Film Festival. That's true. You know, if you want to go meet people, that's where you go. And so out of our own pockets, we just paid to go. And we had very, very shallow pockets. So we, you know, we told the story 1,000 times, but like, we stayed 30 minutes outside of town. It wasn't even called Cannes anymore. You know,
right.
It was another place.
Sure.
And we rented bicycles to get back into town. And it was raining every day, all day during that time. So we were rained on. And we were wearing extraordinarily cheap H&M suits, so we had rained on our H&M suits, and we'd get to the, you know, and it was so crowded, and we couldn't get through crowds, and, you know, meetings, it was terrible, you know, no Wi-Fi, whatever, and there's so people, well, I mean, when you're trying to get somewhere, you don't know where to go, you know, and there were a few people that helped us out, you know, and one of the notable ones just in this particular situation, although Roxanne Benjamin, who's here at this festival right now, she gave us a place to stay for the last 3 days.
She gave us shelter for a night.
We extended our stay a little bit because we needed to scout right after, and we realized we had a couple days of gap after we arranged that. So she gave us a place to stay. Ori Levanon from Horror Nymphs, he gave us a Wi-Fi hotspot. lots and lots of people. The Estonian Pavilion helped us out. Everybody's helped us. But so like
true hobo fashion, we were just taking and not giving. And we will eventually give back to the world, I hope. Anyways, the point being, all we had right then was the script for Spring and Resolution being a sleeper-ish hit, you know. And that's what it was at that time. And so Tim League reached out to us. We'd met him a few times, but not a whole lot. But we met him a few times, and he was still kind of like legendary to us. And absolutely. He's Tim League, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And he said, like, hey, I'd really like to invite you guys over for dinner. And so, you know, all we had was the script for Spring, which we were pushing, and it had nothing else. No financing, no actor attachments. We hadn't scouted, so we didn't know where we could shoot it yet. And he didn't program Resolution at Fantastic Fest for reasons. Not he loves Resolution. They were just, you know, it happens sometimes.
Sure.
But meaning like we're not part of the alumni network. That's the whole point of me saying that. And he reached out when he didn't need to and just said, like, would you like to, and he spent, you know, 6 hours with us. He came and picked us up in his car, took us to his house that he rents in Cannes, and him and his wife cooked us dinner. Wow. And we just kind of chatted for a while, and there were a couple other people there, and we just kind of enjoyed ourselves.
Sure.
And like, you don't need to do that. Nobody needs to do that, especially when you don't pose any actual value. You know, like, we didn't have anything.
It doesn't happen.
We're just trying to get a script made. Yeah. Everybody has a script to get made. Yeah. And he still kind of went out of his way to do that, and it really touched us. And wow. And on top of that, you know, I mean, going with Drafthouse, you know, they... You know, when I was saying earlier, it's like we kind of like to do things a different way just for its own sake because change is healthy. And that's them and like a couple other companies in distribution have that ethos. And it's like it's truly them and a couple others.
Sure.
And everyone else is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
And we're like, you know, and Drafthouse is like, we need to break it. You know, like we need to break it on purpose. And it's really cool. And so... And so, you know, they match our ethos. They gave us a really good deal. You know, they gave us theatrical distribution in more than a tiny, you know, 30 plus cities. That's cool as hell.
Yeah, absolutely.
Got a Mondo poster out of it. That's cool, you know.
Nuts. Did that drop yet?
Dropped.
Yeah, you want to see it?
You want to see it?
Oh, I've seen it.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Okay. I love it.
Oh, you mean drop for sale? I have
no
idea.
Oh, yeah, no, I saw it.
I don't think it's on sale yet, no.
Okay. So in making the film, I mean... Was Lou an option right away, or how did he come into it?
Spring, the life cycle of the business side of it was that getting the business side to fall into place to get the money to make it, fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
Casting the male lead, fucking nightmare. Everything else after that was supernatural easiness. Sure, everything after that, but casting Lou is really, really, really hard because actually Lou and Naughty, those were hard roles to fill because we were for the first time casting through the ways that professionals cast. You absolutely. Go to a talent agency, and
but we still had a missing element though. We didn't have a casting director.
Oh yeah, we didn't have a casting director.
So we're still just
it's
us.
Just us.
Right.
It's just us going to. It's just us and XYZ Films going to agencies and giving a casting breakdown. Which apparently the only thing they actually look at on it is the age range, and they just send you everyone in that age range from their agency.
They're like, maybe we'll get inspired by this, you know, Ethiopian gentleman, you know, and we're just like, that's, did you read this? No, okay, it's okay you didn't read the script, but like this is not useful at all to me right now, you know?
Right.
It's just, yeah, no, it'd literally be like, you know, they'd send us the equivalent to Tara Reid over and over again. And Tara Reid's maybe awesome. I have no idea, but could you imagine Louise played by Tara Reid? And that's the archetype we were getting over and over and over.
Actually, little known fact, we genuinely got very, very, very lightly offered Paris Hilton.
Is that
for that role?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a very light offer. It was just like, hey, just so you know, like if you guys want it, it can happen. You know, that was all it really was, you know. I don't know if she, I don't think she read the script or she even got offered or anything, but it was one of those things like, it can happen if you guys want to pursue it. And we're just like, that. I mean, maybe, you know.
With Naughty, I mean, there's just something so, I mean, you just can't look away. You know, she's just, she reels you in.
I mean, there's luck and then there's like that.
Right.
Yeah. like she just.
Yeah, she's next level.
Yeah.
Yeah. With, you know,
you know, casting Lou was basically, we get sent lists.
Sure.
And, you know, and people attach and drop out, attach and drop out. And that's a total nightmare, yeah. frankly.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, when we found Lou, you know, we don't, and the reason that it took so long to find Lou is because we, you know how I said earlier is like, oh, I didn't grow up on a diet of movies or anything like that. It, like, if it's not that, if even the movies that I did see, I'd never look at the credits. So I didn't know right. who was in them, who directed them, who was the DP, anything like that. So I didn't know anybody. And he's the same way. We don't know anybody's names
sure.
or faces. So it was just a list of names, yeah. which were just words, you know, like words on a page, 400, you know, words on, in an email. And you have to Google them all and hope that you find the right thing that, that presents them well. That was right. the best we could hope for. And you know, luckily Lou stood out because he's Lou. He's spectacular, yeah, you know.
Absolutely.
So that was Lou. Finding Nadia was the reason that I kind of set that up with finding Lou is, you know, when we found him and met with him, you know, and we realized he was right for it. That greenlit the film, and that basically, you know, that was enough for us to say like, okay, we've got our location. I'm pretty sure we can get our financing in line, you know, and we've got our male lead, you know, besides our practical effects company, which we'd already been working with Masters on for quite a while.
Okay.
The last element was Louise.
You know? Yeah. And then, so for several months we had been getting these lists of actresses from big Hollywood agencies. No one girl that was even close. You know, what you're asking for is a young woman that you can't quite place ethnically. That's important to the third act, yeah. and also that she has some odd accent that's pleasant to the ear.
Sure.
And you could say, hey, isn't it an actor's job to know accents? It is. It's not an actor's job to know how to mix an English, Tunisian, French, God knows what accent and make it sound good. It might sound fucking ridiculous,
right.
you know. So she, you know, we're looking for that, and that's to someone who, you know, people use this expression like photogenic. You know, some people find you take a picture of them, and it's like, oh, I like looking at that photograph. Yeah. You might see them in real life and be like, sure, whatever, you know. But it's just there's a weird thing that happens. Well, there's an equivalency to that that is with people that register as being intelligent. And you're just sold on it.
Yeah.
And she required that. So she needed all those things. And she, you know, she needed to have a sensuality about her, but she also needed to be someone that's like, when she says that, you know, I'm here in this little town studying evolutionary genetics, that people aren't like, what?
Right.
Why? Ooh,
sure you are.
Sure you are, Paris Hilton. You're studying.
Right. Yeah.
You're trying to find all those things, and we sent that breakdown.
Oh, there's more, though. There's, yeah. I mean, there's...
she's going to be revealed as Roman?
Yeah, Roman. She had to she had to actually be intelligent in order to understand both the humanity behind what the hell was happening in her role, you know? And then also she had to be... she had to actually be able to do naturalistic acting, you know, which is surprisingly hard.
Sure.
A lot of people, like, they're very, very fun in person, and then you tell them to act, and they
and
start
acting.
You know, and it's just acting. Like, what the hell happened, man? You're so good in person. You know, so, yeah. I mean, like, that's a really, like, one of those little things is a tall order, and we had it six. And we'd been looking for her at the same time as we were looking for Lou, and we hadn't found
nothing. Not
anybody.
Even close.
You know,
and then
there was, like, one, you know, there were, like, one or two that we were, like, maybe, I mean, we got to talk to them, like, maybe they kind of have to look, you know, and like,
sure.
you know, but it wasn't anything that we could, yeah.
So the one tool we had left was that we had made a lot of connections over the International Film Festival circuit with Resolution. And we met a lot of people on the journey to put the packaging together on Spring and scouting locations. So all the producers that we met in that journey, those journeys, we just sent emails out to them and directors as well, and just said, hey, here's our breakdown. This is what we're looking for. Do you know anyone? And she came back on like three different lists.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's crazy to think, like, all of that crazy stuff we did to get the movie made, all of the wild adventures we went on with Resolution, it all culminated in Nadia.
Yeah. Sure.
Like all those weird things, they all kind of like, it's weird. It's, these things are so like, I don't know. It's hard to quantify. It's
everything we do, almost everything we do is really hard to quantify.
Sure.
It's just kind of like an idea that you're like, well, maybe if it catches hold, or like maybe it kind of puts it in some sort of like life bank account of some sort. Right. Of like, I don't know what these travels do besides being like, oh, it's great to be a human and go travel and it's really fun. It empties your bank account and you're tired and hungover all the time, you know. Right. But that's not to complain. I'm just saying like there are actual downsides to doing it all the time. But we don't, you know, you never really know, you know, you just know it's generally a good thing to be doing. And so, you know, my parents have always been super supportive, but it's really hard for them not to just, or for me to convince them to not just partying all the time, which I am on the film festival circuit. They're parties, but they're also work. They, yeah. You know, in that, like, we could not have found Nadia if we'd skipped our film festival circuit. We couldn't have done it. And we couldn't have found Lou. We couldn't have found our financing. We couldn't have scouted Italy. It wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have worked in Cannes. We wouldn't have met Tim League. We wouldn't have had Roxanne putting us up. We wouldn't have had Uri giving us Wi-Fi. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, none of these things would have worked if we hadn't just, like, put some kind of wild, like, you know, generalized investment in the, you know, it's like, this takes time and I don't know what it's for, but it helps, whatever it is. And, you know, and it's not really about catching one fish. It's about casting out a cast net and, yeah, right. You know, and you'll eventually catch something, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, the film's done, you know, I've been stunned by the marketing. I think the marketing's really well done. How much were you guys involved with deciding, well, the BitTorrent bundle? I mean, like,
that was all Drafthouse.
Was that all Drafthouse?
Yeah, that was all Drafthouse, but we were like, so, you know, the story, there's an interesting story behind that, because I'm like, my hobby is like futurism. I will read about, you know, what's going to happen in 5 to 10 years and make my own guesses and get excited about it. That's my little hobby besides like
playing
Grand Theft
Auto.
And in this
business, that's exceptionally, like, you need to have that. I mean, you
right.
need to.
And so, but we weren't involved. Well, I mean, we were asked if we wanted to, but that was it. Like, they set it up. It was just for us. It was a yes or no.
Right.
But yeah, the, you know, Drafthouse being a very disruptive force, like, and BitTorrent being another one. So, you know, actually one of our EPs, Todd Brown, you know, did a fantastic debate at Fantastic Fest with the founder of BitTorrent, right. You know, and it's a real thing. Is like, BitTorrent, you know, is responsible for in many ways, the destruction of film, and is also, but what it is a file format. It's a file format. You know, like, piracy is the problem, right. Not the file format. The file format can deliver decentralized distribution. Sure. That's awesome. Does it work now? No. Is it going to work immediately? No. Can it work?
Sure.
It can be awesome. It can be awesome if it works, you know. And I can see it working because people are embracing the internet, and it's totally fine to throw down your credit card and you get something out of it. You know, you get a Blu-ray for $15.99 immediately. You don't have to go to the store. And on top of that, like, we made our own, like, BitTorrent video. We made a video just for BitTorrent users, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, and you can, you know, tweet at us and interact and stuff like that. And it's a much more personalized experience.
It's ultimately portable. I mean, you put it on a jump drive and it's,
right.
it's everywhere.
And you
it's
own it. You truly own it. There's no DRM. Yeah, there's exactly. no DRM on the file. It's just a file. You get an MP4 or something that's of the insane. Film. And it looks great. You know, I've looked at it. It looks spectacular. It looks like my master render of the film, you know, that we rendered on our own hard drives, you know. And so, and that's not just advertising. The whole point being, you know, something like we were the second film ever distributed this way, and couldn't be more proud of it, just because if it's not the BitTorrent bundle, if that's not the format of the future, it's something like that.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. You know, and anyone that thinks it isn't is fooling themselves, because the, you know, all media now is new media, and that's a fact. And anybody saying differently is pushing back against an unstoppable thing.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I mean, you know, the BitTorrent bundle is, we're just proud to be a part of it. I have no idea if it's actually been profitable or not, or will be, but I do know that that's like the way that films will be done. Sure. Something like that is the way films will be done, if not that.
Great.
So
To kind of wrap up, I mean, what are you guys planning next? Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, we're really far along on a movie about Aleister Crowley.
Oh, wow.
Which has been...
You don't know about this?
You know, no, I didn't know that's what you're working on. That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. We're way far along. We're about to go for it.
Yeah, yeah. We'll probably start shooting in the fall in Scotland. And and it's exciting, right?
We've already scouted for it and everything.
Yeah, we've already scouted
the
patient.
We're going.
Yeah. The script's, you know, it's heading into its last draft, and it's been working on it for since a year from January. January last year. It's been going. It's obviously the most careful thing we've ever done because it's, you know, it's the first serious movie about Aleister Crowley, so you have to take it seriously. Right. But it's a really interesting project. It treats him as neither a hero nor a villain. It's not, you know, there's 5,000 people that worship Thelema that may be mildly offended by it, but probably not.
Aleister Crowley would love it.
Aleister Crowley himself would love it. There's probably 5,000 people who are part of the Aleister Crowley hate club that might hate it because he's not totally villainizing it. But it really is just a story about a guy who, you know, we researched his life for about a year and we found the most interesting things. And it's a biopic.
You'll be surprised by the format, but it worked. But we
get it all in there. Okay. You know? Yeah, it's basically, it's a fictionalized telling of him performing the Abramelin at his house along Loch Ness, and in this fictionalized telling, we have made it so he has decided to perform the Abramelin in 1 week. Most people need 6 months; he needs 1 week, and it's about. It's everything that happens is like heavily, heavily inspired by his life and very much in the spirit of who he was and just an examination of the first counterculture icon, you know, and how he's an analog for counterculture icons of today, but he was the first one and how he gets corrupted by his own alter ego, this creation of this like parallel person who, you know, you look him up on Wikipedia, one of the most striking things in it is Aleister Crowley is remembered as a Satanist, but he didn't believe in Satan. So this movie delves into that question, why is that? And it's really about like, he's the first guy who's like really savvy to manipulating the press, you know, and he loves it. And he's funny and he's well-intentioned, but there's things he couldn't possibly know in 1899 that we know today.
Sure.
That, like, you know, so many of his viewpoints are really admirable, but from a modern standpoint, it's easy to judge him, but like given the time period, it's like, oh no, that was, you know, he's not whitewashed in the movie at all whatsoever, but you can definitely empathize with him.
Yeah. Sure. Definitely, actually, at that time in his life, because the movie takes place when he's about 25.
Okay.
But at that time in his life, he wasn't even... He wouldn't have been called the wickedest man in the world. Whereas you watch the movie and you're like, yeah, I kind of see why they call him. So we are pressure cookering his life into like a smaller space, you know. It's interesting that, you know, Aleister Crowley is kind of has become a little bit of an obsession of ours, you know, and we realized just how much he actually pops up. You know, just watched the Paradise Lost documentaries and found out, you know, Aleister Crowley was part of those trials. Yeah. Going Clear, apparently he's in Going Clear quite a bit.
Right? Yeah.
He's all over pop culture, but nobody's made a movie. We're gonna be the first, like a real one about him. He's inspired a lot, but nobody really wants to seem to touch the Satanist, which is, of course, for the whole thing that we're talking about with, you know, it's just like shake it up just for its own sake. It's kind of exciting it's been interesting because now we take a bit of a personal stake whenever he pops up again. Every time it's just like, Aleister Crowley popped up in Paradise Lost. Like, that's awesome. You know, like, whatever, stuff like that. I think the script is the best thing that Justin's ever written, personally. Wow. And he's the best writer I know, or the best writer that I know of, I should say. And so, you know, that's something that I'm just kind of, I just want to go shoot it.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Yeah. That's really exciting. I can't wait to see that.
Of course.
Well, guys, thanks so much. It's been a hell of a show, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a lot to us.
Yeah, so. Of course.
For a bigger show, this has been Mike D. Thank you all so much for listening, and we will catch you next week. Goodbye.
Actually, wait.
Oh.
I'm sorry. I just realized if you guys want to
chat with us, we're actually really available on Twitter.
Yeah, awesome. Tweet at us.
This is I know this is really minor, but we really like the audience engagement stuff. So, you know, if you have a question, just hit us up. Justin is at Justin H. Benson, and I'm at Aaron Moorhead. Please spell it M-O-O-R-H-E-A-D without the E in the middle. But yeah, hit us up, honestly, for whatever you want.
Awesome. There it is, guys. We will see you next time. Goodbye. We're gonna need a big show. We're gonna need a big